The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't see...
We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Well, hey there, Zero Books readers, listeners, and subscribers. It's me, but it's a different me than you usually expect. It is Badman Massive filling in for Douglas Lane. In this very special Zero Squared episode, I'm going to be interviewing Mike Watson, who is a content creator at The Acid Left. He is also a Zero Books author, and he's also doing some interesting political work in his hometown of Oulu in Finland. I always enjoy our conversation, so it's really good to have you on, Mike.
Thank you. Always good to talk. And of course, it'd be great to have you back on our podcast sometime.
Well, yeah, that'd be great. And that seems kind of like the perfect place to start. So tell me a little bit about the work that you do with your podcast and the kind of mixed multimedia stuff that you do with The Acid Left. What is that?
Yeah, I'm making memes, podcasts and videos. And I have this platform called The Acid Left with Adam Ray Atkins and Terry Tapp. And we release podcasts about every 2 weeks and we make lots of memes.
I've listened to it a little bit myself, and it's not just dank memes and good crack. Your work seems to be kind of deeply political as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, well, apart from the podcast where we speak about this kind of thing, and actually we had Matt McManus on, who's written for Zero Books, and he really amazed us because in the very end we got onto what do you think about the left maybe needing to reconnect with, you could say, its soul or spirituality. And he actually said very strongly that he thinks that the left society as such is in need of something like that. I don't think he was advocating religion, but, you know, I think we all need to kind of like take a step back and should we just say find ourselves? Because if you haven't found yourself, you can't really find or kind of enact anything else. But we talk about those kind of things. But in the actual video making and art making, we try and blend music as much as possible with just kind of off-kilter and glitched visuals, which I suppose have a parallel with art movements like surrealism, also abstraction. But I guess we're trying to equal the avant-garde, what the avant-garde was up to in the 1800s, 1900s. Anything kind of off-kilter which can kind of shock you out of your complacency.
Yeah, so from the stuff I've seen you produce, I kind of get the feeling that it's a bit of a Fisherian kind of vaporwave aesthetic with all that kind of cool glitchcore stuff and, you know, kind of hearkening to forgotten futures, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, vaporwave's a big influence, although it does have a strongly nihilistic aspect. I suppose what we're doing is like vaporwave meets kind of Mark Fisher's suggestions in his introduction to the unfinished work, Acid Communism, where he introduces the term Acid Communism as a way of like using creativity, seminars, get-togethers to raise class consciousness. So we're kind of like using this weirdness, which is influenced by anything from like hippie culture, like going back towards Dadaism and various other avant-garde movements. We're kind of using that to kind of push a left-wing agenda, maybe slightly in a more forthright way, or maybe like in a slightly more positive way than vaporwave.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I guess like vaporwave as a kind of artistic philosophy speaks to what Mark Fisher might call the, you know, the slow cancellation of the future, whereas from your work it kind of seems to be more important to bring in the kind of Fisherian idea of, you know, shared collective joy as being both the site of struggle and kind of the role of art as well.
For sure, yeah. And I think Also, I mean, he just talked about the need for working class people to understand that they are working class and to refine their own culture, which is interesting because certainly I don't think that's very easy to do through a kind of far out psychedelic culture, because that's just going to deter some working class people. So I think you need a kind of multi approach. You need to kind of meet people on different terms. But I know, you know, no one really knows where that was going with Fisher's interpretation of acid communism. And I think, you know, we have to just take that as a departure point and be willing to kind of deal with whatever's happening now, because things are moving so fast, you know, that we have to, I think, believe in our own ability to come up with solutions. Because I think one issue is young people are getting very into the left, or it seems. I mean, we're in a bit of a bubble, but I mean, there's like a growing kind of group of people between 16 and 25, you know, really young, who are getting into the left wing, expressing it through memes. They're on like Facebook groups around Fisher, around the Frankfurt School, etc.
So obviously I'm a degenerate millennial, but I have maximum respect for our comrades at the vanguard of the cultural revolution that are kicking stuff off on TikTok. Have you seen any of that stuff?
Yeah, I have been looking at a bit. Yeah, and this is also interesting. A lot of them are like really tanky. There's like a Chinese tanky or pro-China tanky brigade, and you just wonder how serious they are, or if they're kind of missing something in, you know, well, because they're very young. I mean, I know tankies. I always took you as a tankie when I first met you.
Jesus.
But I think this was more of a...
Oh, here we go.
But I mean, the thing is, I don't know. I mean, maybe I am just getting old, but I mean, I just see this as there's not a solution. You're talking about, you know, situations that can result in very violent revolutions, but partly just because I don't see any way that we can win a fight against the US or UK government, etc., because the hardware they have is so sophisticated and just brutal today. And we don't have anything, really. In America, they have a lot of guns, actually. Maybe there it's more possible.
Sure, we'd always make time for a bit of a protracted people's war, innit?
But even then, they're really, you know, the stuff, the gear that the government have is just way superior. So when someone at 16 is telling me, like, you know, you're a fucking neo-lib because you don't support an outright revolution immediately, you know, I just kind of wonder if they need kind of a better grasp on history.
Although I'm certainly not opposed to revolutionary struggle as a means to kind of bringing about the socialism that we need. I think maybe there is kind of a youthful naivety among young people or whatever that, you know, that comes across when, in the way that they kind of discuss these ideas. I think it's kind of sweet and well-meaning.
It might be youthful naivety, just thinking like, yeah, let's just go for it. And of course, you feel kind of a bit immortal at that age. And I can kind of relate to that. And I think, you know, these people are useful. But what, and it's great that they're getting into this so young. But what I really wanted to say is that there's a lot of like, you know, what did Fisher think? What did Marx think? Well, Marx is a particular case. He's almost like an event rather than a man. You know, so I think one can ask, what did Marx think? But it's more a phenomenon, you know. But I would try and deter people from worrying too much about what X, Y, Z person would think. You know what I mean? Even Adorno, who I'm a big Adornian. But we need to kind of believe in the ability to come up with solutions now. And this is one issue with meme and online culture, because they're very much like fixed on one is a tanky, one is a Marxist, one is following Adorno, you know, and you've got to go back to the text and ask, what would they think at this moment? They don't think anything because they're not around, and our culture is so very different from theirs. So I think we have to use them to grow something new, you know, as tools.
Yeah, for sure. I'm by no means the most kind of educated Marxist or a brilliant theorist on the left, but I think that... you know, theory for all its place is only really useful in terms of how you can kind of relate it to struggle directly, and like how you can use it to understand the world and then kind of intervene in the world on the terms of your understanding.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's very important. Yeah.
Yeah. To some degree, I think we're kind of seeing that now. It's like, in what way do activists apply kind of theoretical ideas to what's emerging in the United States around the BLM kind of stuff and the struggles that have been kind of built up around that?
Well, I mean, that's, to me, looking like really interesting and positive. I mean, I'm always, I suppose, of this kind of, I have to question how much one can speak for a movement which is about other people's experience, but certainly, you know, it's very strong within the left, and I think we need to like be able to unite different movements. But this gets into intersectionalism, which I don't think you're, I mean, are you convinced by intersectionalism, or would you say we just need more to make everyone socialist?
Well, I guess there's a function for intersectionality. It has its place in kind of academic thought, but I'd be accused of being a class reductionist, and maybe that accusation is somewhat true. It's like, while I can acknowledge that all these kind of struggles based around identity are, you know, really important and are probably going to be the fundamental basis of any kind of movements that we build, I would say that the base from which those kind of oppressions emerge is rooted fundamentally in class, and we should have a Marxist class analysis to try and understand it.
Well, I mean, I think like BLM, and I mean, it's a bit different, but recent kind of feminist movements and movements around sexuality online, like hashtag Me Too. I mean, they've really led the left in many ways the last few years, but actually maybe for decades even, in terms of like the left being reclaiming your body, which really I think Marxism is about, is like who has control over your body so that you're not just a tool for producing labor value. I think feminists and kind of various kind of race-based movements have been very, very effective at saying that, you know, we're in control of our body and identity. And also around sexuality. But, you know, that needs to be combined with an economic analysis.
Yeah, somehow. You know, I'd acknowledge that there's a truth to that. But I think the kind of the cultural gains that have come about from these kinds of movements, like be it the feminist movement or the LGBT trans rights stuff, which of course is extremely important, those gains are somewhat limited and to an even greater degree directed by, you know, the way that our society is ordered on an economic level. Like, I feel like cultural gains are only really victories if they're consolidated in a material way. So, like, I guess one example that I might use is that, like, abortion as a cultural demand is great and all, and, you know, women have the right to bodily autonomy, and this is something that's a really important socialist demand. But, like, that cultural victory on its own is kind of worthless unless, you know, you literally have a situation where free abortion is provided at a place that women can actually access and get it, so it's provided for everyone. And I guess that's where I might draw the distinction between more identity-based politics and like politics rooted in a class analysis.
Well, I mean, that's true, but as you know, it's not like historically these movements have been saying they're opposed to kind of how can we say, to fair economic conditions or to socialism or communism as such. I mean, the Black Panthers describe themselves as socialist, no? I believe.
Well, I guess I would see them as the most kind of based red pill kind of socialist in that they were Maoists. But yeah, definitely socialist.
But yeah, I don't know whether the further kind of difficulty to make one kind of cohesive movement comes in. I guess people are fundamentally I suppose egotistical, that they get people get kind of upset easily. We all have our identity, and we all, you know, I think we're all guilty of this. I'm guilty of this. Like, you, someone can say they have it hard, and they imply by saying they have it hard that you don't have it difficult. You know, your life isn't difficult. So then you're kind of on a defensive, saying, "Well, hey, I grew up with no money." Blah 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 blah. You know, the right wing are very good at exploiting this kind of ego and people being emotional through exploiting fear, basically. The left seem to be constantly divided by that same thing, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think the right have this kind of weird structural advantage in a way. It's that it's much easier to kind of just like draw from a past, whether it be a real or an imagined past in the case of the far right, and say, you know, this is the utopian past that we had before, and, you know, suddenly all these problems have come in, and, you know, we need to get rid of the degeneracy and you know, excommunicate all the baddies in order to get it back to that way. Whereas, you know, trying to kind of inspire people to believe that a transformed future is possible, you know, that's a much more difficult task. And I think to some degree, the work that you're doing with the Acid Left kind of touches on that a little bit, no? The whole thing is called the Acid Left, right, Mike?
The Acid Left is the name of the platform. We have a YouTube and we actually have a Patreon, which you can look up, and it ranges from, I think it's $3 or €3 up to, I think, 20. But you get things like, you get meme packs sent to you, which basically are the kind of the best memes we've made over the last month or so, and which you can download and use, manipulate, and you get tuition on making memes and making art and kind of extra podcast essays, art reviews, etc. So I think that's a great, Patreon's a great thing. I really hope publishing's moving this way. Not to kind of want to like throw Zero in a difficult position, but Zero have their Patreon anyway. So
yeah, and it's a Patreon which all of our listeners right now should be donating to if you're not already. And I'll also drop the Acid Left Patreon and links to it in the show notes as well, so everyone can have a look.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
So Mike, I guess it's fair to say that you wrote the book on memes, you know, just to plug it again, the book is called Can the Left Learn to Meme, and it's available from Zero Books on both Amazon and on the Zero Books website. But on that basis, so we've all been dealing with this weird global pandemic situation, and I thought you'd be the exact man to ask, like, how has this particular kind of experience that we've all gone through, like, do you think that has kind of transformed what internet culture and memes are going to look like down the line, or has it already made some changes?
Well, basically, with the lockdown, yeah, I mean, that was kind of a big disruption for everyone. And I suppose the only big bonus was that it led to a massive boom in online culture. And then also like a togetherness through that people had to suddenly come together online. And there is something about like online persona or the society or interaction that it creates, that it can suddenly become like very big, that you can suddenly find networks. So it created this sense of positivity and people doing stuff online politically. I guess the real issue is, how is that going to translate now? Like, can we take that and bring it outdoors on the street? And also the art world. I mean, the art world suddenly got all online. Of course, the art world, meaning like the world of museums, galleries, etc., was already online, in that they had websites, they had Facebooks. But it's like they saw online as something secondary. But then suddenly they were using Twitch, etc., Instagram in different ways, encouraging meme competitions and, you know, memes around art, like getting people to dress up as artworks and stuff, famous artworks. But I'm seeing that's like, was really seen as something for the moment, because they felt restricted, so they had to go online. That's not really happening. So I think politically as well, we might see that some of the energy that was being formed, people saying we got to resist, the governments are going to use this lockdown for other means, etc. People, I think there's a lot of feeling actually, you know, everyone became a conspiracy theorist, that this was going to be used to lock us down permanently, etc. It probably is being used in all kind of heinous ways. But actually, a lot of governments have been taken too off guard by the whole thing, or are just too incompetent to have used it very effectively to control us. Like the apps that were proposed didn't manifest or are just quite useless for anything. And no one's taking them up, so they're not very good for surveillance. But I mean, yeah, can we take the energy that was there among the left-wing community and take it onto the streets? I don't know. But I mean, there are positive movements that happened before, just shortly before lockdown, like the Sardines movement in Italy, which is basically a movement against the right-wing Northern League leader Salvini. And Salvini basically was in a bid to take Emilia-Romagna, the region around Bologna, which had always been a left stronghold. I mean, it's like strong, people are, you know, properly communist there. You know, it's like got history linking to the partisans post-war, during World War II. And it would have been quite something if he had taken it, or something disturbing if the League, Northern League, had taken it. So what it did is they made this Sardines movement. Basically, it was a group of young people in Bologna who said, let's all gather in the central piazza on a given date. I think it was in November. And then we will, I think it was called Bologna non si lega, which is kind of it means it will not kind of like, Bologna will not take up with this idea, will not become part of the Northern League. But it was kind of a wordplay because it was non seed Lega, Lega being the league being called the Lega in Italy. But anyway, so they expected a few thousand people. They got many, they got I guess 20,000 or so. And these people all started to sing Bella Ciao, the famous partisan song. And there's famous footage of that. And when it came to election, the left party won strongly, and Salvini was showed that he couldn't, with his brand of actually very much internet-based campaigning, he couldn't take that to a less stronghold. And it's been seen as a setback to Salvini. So that was a movement that grew up online. It was kind of a flash mob. So, you know, it grew up online but happened in real life, or led on to a real life happening. So it's that kind of thing that we need, and whether we can take the online togetherness, because there was a real sense of like, we're all alone in our houses, but we're together online. If we could take that and bring it into the political arena, the concrete IRL meet space arena. But it's not really happening. Have you seen it happening?
I think you can see it a little bit in the BLM stuff that's going on in the US. Obviously, there's more potential there, and it's something that we could, should continue to work towards. But yeah, I like to think the embryos of that.
And that's why, obviously, that's the one that just hadn't. I didn't see it in that sense. But of course, it is. That is. But again, that's going back the BLM, Me Too, and kind of civil rights movements in the past, feminist movements in the past, movements around sexuality. They're all like inspiring people more than the socialist left, I think. But it's great that they are. I mean, so, you know, BLM kind of leading the way there. But I think that was a great feeling of anger generally meeting the lockdown and people suddenly going out onto the streets and protesting for, you know, the rights they should have already. I mean, great. I mean, we should learn from that, really. I think we all have to learn from, the socialism has to learn from all these other movements.
Mike, I guess you are particularly well placed to try and learn some of these lessons and implement them, in being that you are running as a local councillor in Oulu, where you live. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, basically, I'm from the UK and I spent around 10 years in Italy before moving to where I am now, which is a place in kind of north or central to North Finland called Oulu. And yeah, basically, I found myself here involving myself in local politics, and I'll be running in April 2021 for the Left Alliance, or Vasemmisto, which is basically the local left of centre, or the kind of Finnish left of centre party, kind of, I guess, more left than Corbyn. But this is complicated a bit because Finland anyway is naturally kind of left because it has this welfare system we all hear about, the kind of Nordic model where you get free education, very good kind of unemployment and housing benefits, etc. Yet they don't really consider themselves to be left. That's just kind of like the base level. So anyway, I mean, I'm in a left party in a country that's kind of naturally towards a kind of welfare model.
So I guess, like many people, I actually don't know a huge ton about Finnish politics. I know that there's like an emerging far-right movement that's become kind of popular. Is there like a similar emerging situation for the left, or is it like the left worldwide just kind of resting on its laurels?
I mean, there's this Finns party, often called the True Finns. And apparently the translation is more like Basic Finns, which is kind of funny.
The base Finns.
But I think they're actually called literally now the Finns Party officially. And they're right of centre. They're kind of populist right. They're very anti-immigration, and that's really one of the things they lead on. And I think they're the second party in Parliament now. And the main party is the Social Democrat Party, who actually formed the government with the Left Alliance and the Green Party, and I think the Swedish People's Party, the Swedish Party rather. But this True Finns are certainly worrying. But I think they're really something towards the Tories in England and Donald Trump. But of course, that is deeply worrying anyway. And we hope they don't get in power. But their election's in 3 years, the next general election. And right now, Sanna Marin's party, she's a prime minister. You would have seen, very young female prime minister. I mean, She's doing very well. In the polls, they're doing very well. Well, we're 3 years out, so we have to be constantly vigilant against the possibility of the far right rising, especially given the situation with the coronavirus, which was not terrible here, but the coming recession, etc., does pose risks.
So you put a lot of emphasis on memes in terms of transforming public consciousness. Are you going to do some cool meme stuff in relation to your own campaign? What have you got planned?
Yeah, I mean, it being a local election, I certainly think it will be very internet-based, because if it wasn't internet-based, it would be largely leafleting. So leafleting I'm all up for, and going out and meeting the electorate. I think, being that I've been researching memes for a long time, I have intentions of running this in a large part online. How effective that will be, I don't know. I think it's a case of like looking into the kind of terms people are using, what kind of excites people now, what agitates or annoys people now, and using that to make videos and memes, and hopefully that will appeal to the public. I'll certainly be doing a lot of that, yeah.
So what I really want to know is, what's the far right meme situation in Finland as well? Like, are they absolutely popping off with loads of dank memes, kind of similar to, what we see in the UK, the US and the West? Or what's the deal? How are these based Finns spreading their ideology?
They do have like figures like Pepe the Frog. They have this, I think it's Spado Spade. It's like a potato, kind of distorted potato. It actually comes from, it looks like a kind of distorted potato figure, but it actually comes from Pedo Bear, which is a bear that used to be put on Chan sites to alert of kind of unsavory material featuring minors.
Yeah, I remember that particularly grim period of internet history. But I tell you what, we might have to put this dude on our thumbnail for the podcast.
Maybe, yeah. I'm not sure. But they have a distorted figure of this... this bear, which is basically, anyway, it's basically been manipulated, and it sometimes features it features in right-wing memes a bit like Pepe the Frog does. And then they have this kind of mythology called, I think it's Fingolia, which is like Finland meets Mongolia. It's a bit like Kekistan, the alt-right American kind of fake nation, and it has a flag and everything, and basically comes from like folklore from around 2010. It started on Reddit around the Finns being part Mongolian. This explains the kind of different facial head structure and very unusual language, and the kind of very hardiness, like the toughness of Finns. So there's a whole kind of lore and whole culture which is often associated with the right wing, about kind of racial superiority, racial traits related to the Mongolian roots, which is all very speculative, and I think more of a kind of a joke. But yeah, it's a similar kind of thing to what's happening with the alt-right and Kekistan. So you get this kind of thing. And the left, I don't see such a strong identity of their meme culture, to be honest. I see kind of, jokes around politicians. Maybe like if you have a politician giving a demonstration with a whiteboard, a bit like you have with Bernie, they kind of like impose different lettering over the, they kind of change what they're writing or whatever, this kind of jokes. But to my knowledge, I haven't seen like a very strong identity around particular kind of cartoon figures, etc. yet. But I don't think you see that in America so much with the left.
Jesus, Mark, are you saying the left can't meme, is it?
Well, this was the thing with Momentum and the campaign in the UK around Labour at the end of last year, is that I don't think we really knew how to meme, or maybe we weren't really allowed to in that way. I'm not saying anything against individuals involved, but the campaign was really pushing like a people's memeing, get people hashtagging like Tory story, hashtag Tory story, make a video of like 30 seconds, 1 minute, telling people about the bad things the Tories have done. This was generally, this is kind of the tone of the campaign. it was felt that like a load of young people making far out left memes wouldn't have been the way to appeal to the mass of the public. But on the other hand, what you ended up having was a lot of people just complaining about their tough luck stories. It was bland. It wasn't effective ultimately. So yeah, I mean, I think the left wing has to kind of rise up a bit. I don't know. I think it's a general problem. There's a left wing, it kind of worries about telling a very bold story. So the right wing are saying like, okay, we need to make a racially pure country. That's an extreme. Obviously, that's not being said in probably many countries by serious political parties. But the dialogue is a bit one of, we need to make a strong country, take a country back, free it from Europe, etc., etc. These kind of discourses are very simple, and they're one that kind of make people feel part of a heroic narrative. The left have a heroic narrative to tell. It's overthrowing the ruling class. I mean, obviously you're not going to say that. Obviously that's not as simple as that. It's more like, let's make a fair society for all. Making the fairest society known to man, wouldn't that be, something to be part of? But we're not really getting that across with any kind of real strength. It's more like, I had to wait 3 years for a cataract operation under the Tories. That's not really inspiring people.
Yeah, for sure. And I think even in a way that this kind of, what do you call it, negative pity politics, it kind of forces people to associate, perhaps like the Labour movement or the left, like with fucking negativity and austerity. And like these are maybe ideas that you wouldn't want associated with a Labour Party either, like rightly or wrongly. Obviously, they have their own legacy in terms of austerity.
Yeah, it's a real problem. But what I would really say is we need a kind of memeing. What I've started to call, actually, and what I might work on for a future book, the slow meme. We need a kind of slow meme movement, because actually what's happening with memes is they're kind of pushing us to adopt the speed of the internet, or the speed that the data economy wants us to work at. So we tend to like consume memes very quickly and make them actually very quickly. And what a slow meme movement would be is more of like a considered approach to memes and the considered way of receiving them or looking at them, so that, you get to reflect a bit, and in reflecting, maybe think of better ways forward politically or as a society. So again, a kind of abstract meme making, but this isn't something for election campaigns in the immediate future. I mean, we have to deal with what's now. I think this is, it's very much actually in the book is told as a kind of Adornian stance from Theodore Adorno, who said that, one can't benefit really from a figurative or very direct political art making, but it just plays back into the conflict. We need a kind of abstract art production which can kind of throw us out of our false kind of conditions of living, and false conditions being living under capitalism. And that's very, very good generally as a way of like living your life and consuming art, I think. But it's not going to work in the conditions we're living in now. Okay, this is terrible. We need Biden to win the election. We need to get rid of Trump. We're not going to get that from kind of meditative, abstract memes. You're going to have to tell very direct stories, which make people feel in control of their lives and part of what is a battle. This point of we need to get Biden in is very debatable, and I'm not actually voting in America, but you get my point.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree that we should vote for Biden myself, but I can see where people are coming from and why they're so afraid of Trump. Obviously, there's a real danger there.
But if we don't use Biden, then we just say we need to defeat white supremacy or something. Oh, we need to defeat inequality or capitalism or whatever. But these things which are feeling very much at the moment like conflicts in the immediate term, we do need some kind of strong message, basically. But I think in the long term, we need to get beyond strong messages and beyond conflicts as such. But this is very, it gets almost Buddhist in this sense. So I think we've got to fight two battles, really, the immediate one and one towards just a better kind of humanity.
Is there a bit of a contradiction there, maybe, between, trying to use the electoral system to, to attack the very real danger of Trump and fascism, But like focusing our energy in that, it could kind of prevent us from building the dual power that we need to really kind of tackle the challenges of late stage capitalism. And
well, I mean, you may be, but I don't know if there's a contradiction, because I think, you know, there's effects that happen day to day, year to year, and there's an election coming, and there are two options which are a little bit different. There's no doubt that they're a bit different. There's leaving Trump in and empowering him when he is clearly not capable, and there's replacing Trump with someone else, and it wouldn't be empowering an existing leader who has very worrying ideas. So you get Biden in, who's bad, but he has to start again. So you're disrupting a system. You're not enabling a continuum. You're actually, if it is a continuum between Republican and Democrat, and they're basically the same, you're at least to some extent, you know, exactly disrupting that continuum and forcing the slowdown. But actually, no, I wouldn't even go that far. I mean, I think Trump is very different to Biden.
Is there any hope that the left within the Democratic Party can push the whole party leftward, or is it a lost game?
Well, I mean, this is the level of Biden. It doesn't look good for Democrats. So, and this, okay, so it does sound like a contradiction, but I mean, I think coming up from the grassroots and from Congress, maybe in the Senate. The senators, some of the senators coming up who may be able to run, who will be able to run in a few years for the presidency, offer something for sure. But whether they'll just suffer the same thing as Sanders, I don't know. I mean, I can't see Ocasio-Cortez getting the nomination in a few years' time. I think she would suffer more than Sanders. You know, I think the Democratic Party is deeply flawed. I think it is maintaining the status quo largely. And it's like Labour. It's full of these people who don't want socialism. You know, they don't want to lose what they have. They don't want to lose their privilege. So I mean, so obviously in the long run, we need something else. But there's an election coming. We need to do the best thing. I mean, we, the voters in America, need to do the best thing, the only thing they can do in that election. And they need to carry on building a movement, such that someone like Ocasio-Cortez can finally get a nomination, and maybe she's not radical enough for you, but then, you know, you can carry on from there. But yeah, I mean, the vote takes a few minutes. You may have to queue for an hour, but a vote doesn't take long. So go and vote, and go and vote Trump, out, and then in the meantime, build a socialist movement.
If they don't close polling stations early and attempt to rig it, which I'm sure they will. But back to Finland and Oulu. Is when are our listeners from Finland, which I'm sure there are many, when are they going to get an opportunity to vote for you?
It's actually April next year, late April. The exact date I don't recall. It's one of the last days of April. And yeah, I mean, well, I should say my policies, actually. But I'm all for integration. Oulu has an issue with integration. Actually, Finland as such has welcomed a lot of new visitors or migrants in recent years, basically its EU quota, but that quota has kind of number overall has increased because we've had things like the Syria conflict, and so you have Finnish people suddenly dealing with a lot more foreign people than they were meeting day to day. Oulu I first came to around 12 years ago and noted, as someone living in London at the time, that there weren't any non-white people, which if you were living in London at the time and left wing is the kind of thing you were noticing and kind of, you know, you would express concern. But it was just because, you know, it's right in the north of Finland. It's not like people are flocking to live here. But now there is a kind of EU quota system and a redistribution of migrants around the country. So we have, you know, a lot of people from, it could be Syria, Somalia, Afghanistan, and so on, Iraq. There's been a problem. There was a recent case, 2018, I think it was, of basically sex grooming, child sex grooming of teenage girls by immigrants. It was around 20, I think. I think it was around just less than 10 that were finally convicted, but possibly more that were involved through the internet and in real life. And it actually fed into the right-wing vote. And then people would say, okay, this is a reason we shouldn't welcome these immigrants in. I would argue, actually, it's a kind of lack of structures to welcome people. How could you say? A lack of integration rather than too much integration. This maybe these things wouldn't happen if we were interacting more with foreigners here. And that's something that's some way off. So we need to build structures to interact with incoming immigrants and welcome them better so that they're not kind of hidden away and they're not, you know, doing these things out of desperation that we can't see them even doing because we're not talking to them, you know what I mean? So I think that's a major thing. And then also another thing happening is that Oulu is running for a European City of Culture 2026, which is a way off, but there's this kind of bid. There are cultural events, and I've actually been active in that, running an art event last year, a performance event, and I'm very interested that Oulu gets the city bid, but also that this is open to everyone, that anyone that basically considers themselves an artist or who wants to learn art skills will be involved in Oulu being the City of Culture for Europe 2026. So these kind of things, basically immigration and culture are the things I'm running on.
Well, that sounds great, and I really wish you the best of luck with that. And I would say that all of our Zero Books readers, listeners and watchers should nip over to Finland and do some voter fraud to make sure our boy gets in. That's a joke, by the way. I'm kind of aware that I haven't actually talked about your book at all yet. I guess, what's it been? It feels like years and years since it came out, because the world has been so absolutely insane. To quote the big man, there are decades where nothing happens and there are weeks where decades happen and all that.
It's actually, it may feel like that, it's because we did promo from quite early on, but it's it was November. It was actually December the 1st in America. So,
well, on the basis that so much has happened and it's been so weird, do you think that all your analysis still holds up? Is there anything you would change or add?
Well, I mean, the book came out November, I think, 31st, and it was December the 1st in the UK, sorry, in the US. So it was basically end of November, beginning of December. And it came out, we hadn't obviously planned for this, right during the election, the last weeks of the UK election. So it suddenly kind of took on, how can we say it? It kind of acquired an importance, I don't know for who, but certainly for me, but for anyone who was paying attention, in light of there being this election coming. So the question became, can the left meme for Corbyn? And, you know, apparently it didn't. It didn't come through. We didn't manage to swing the election through memes. And I was working a bit with Momentum, the kind of UK campaign group, online, because I was in Finland then already. And basically, yeah, I mean, the campaign, maybe it didn't work entirely as we planned. But since then, I mean, what else has happened? I mean, I suppose Boris Johnson's been possibly more right-wing and more clumsy than we even thought. In the US, of course, we had Bernie Sanders not getting the nomination, despite Ocasio-Cortez's best efforts yesterday to nominate him at the conference. So, you know, I think that things are not looking brilliant for the left. And, you know, we have Biden hopefully winning in America, but that's also terrible because he's basically a conservative. You know, are things working for the left? And are they working through memes and through internet culture? I don't really think so. I think what we're seeing happen is a kind of growing left community online, but it's not translating to concrete politics. And actually the book kind of suggests anyway that the kind of thing that we're seeing in memes, left-wing memes, won't in itself be effective, because it tends to play into an existing conflict that isn't really generative. It doesn't create solutions. So you have, from 2016, classically, we always say that the right wing helped Trump win with their kind of very racist memes. And the left kind of responded, it seems, by going very far left. So you have like this tankies on the left versus these Nazis on the right. To me, that's not very productive. But then you also have identity politics memeing, so memeing around gender, race, sexuality, etc., which, I mean, of course, to some extent, it's positive if it raises issues, but it also, I think, because the nature of memes being very sudden, it creates also conflicts. It's kind of like my gender versus yours, rather than kind of resolving things. So, I mean, the book actually says what we need is more of an abstract meme production, which I kind of, I use Vaporwave as an example, because Vaporwave, this kind of online music art movement, is just kind of very bizarre. It doesn't really propose things, but in its kind of weird negativity, it makes you think. And I think we need to kind of have more space to reflect. And that's why I would still say is that we need memes that are abstract, bizarre, that lead you into quasi-meditation, which is what we're trying to do with the Acid Left platform, is kind of talk about maybe things a bit, should we say, left-field, but kind of like the kind of weird side of the left, psychedelia, sometimes spirituality even. Not that we don't want to be like incisive and strong, but that we kind of see that the weirdness of the right and the weirdness of the general situation that prevails today, and Trump is very weird and Boris Johnson's being very weird, we can only combat with an equal weirdness. We need an abstraction to take on the abstraction of the right and capitalism.
So are you going to be bringing these ideas to different platforms? What's next for you? Following your election, of course.
Well, I'm actually working on two books now. One called Down and Out in the Art World. So kind of taking the title from George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London, where Orwell pretended to be poor and hang out with poor people. I didn't pretend. I was actually without any money in the art world in Italy. And it's kind of my stories of just crazy things I saw. A lot of kind of quite bad behavior from people who ran galleries and art foundations, some of the things that goes on in art journalism. So that's kind of like a picaresque kind of look at the art world from my own perspective. So between a theory book and a novel, and I'm kind of right now working out how that's going to work. I've got some tens of thousands written. And then the other one is basically on Benjamin saying that the mass reproduction of art gave people the kind of impetus to ask for more power, and the right wing kind of staving that off, or kind of responding to that by offering people power, but kind of in the most heinous way, kind of by scapegoating immigrants, etc., and making parallels with today and the kind of Instagram, YouTube, inspiring people to want more and more to be famous, to be wealthy, but then not being able to completely deliver on that. So that leading to, I think, Trump's success and Johnson's success, etc. So a very parallel situation. I'm going to talk about how to deal with that. So that book, I mean, I'm kind of putting down one book and starting another. So I think they'll both be finished at some point next year.
Brilliant. That sounds great. I'll be looking forward to reading your insights. Thank you very much, Mike Watson, for coming on the show and having a chat with me. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Always good to talk. And of course, it'd be great to have you back on our podcast sometime.
I am down, my G. Just give me a ping.
Great.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.